K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets here most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and all the fine details connected to that. It is a belief of mine that inside of a true ham radio operator is a kind of a scientist who would like to know a little bit more about what Mother Nature is saying as to how all this stuff works. One of the main things that Mel and I believe that the TechNet provides is connections. It turns out that there's a lot of brain power in the tri-state area of New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. Lots of ham radio operators in that area, or people who are about to become ham radio operators, have got lots of questions. And with all that brain power, we try to provide those connections by which the guys with the experience can tell the guys with the questions what they think is going on, and outline some experiments to confirm those beliefs. And the only way you really prove something is by an experiment, a physical experiment, hopefully that's one that can be duplicated by somebody else in some other laboratory. By the time an experiment gets properly reported in the right kind of a peer-reviewed journal, and other people can duplicate the experiment, it becomes a kind of scientific truth, or at least a strongly held belief with a lot of evidence that it's quite possibly accurate. That's sort of what goes on. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. I'll be accepting those check-ins in a minute. What normally happens is that for the first hour, we try to answer everyone's questions who sign in with at least a brief answer. That means that in theory, on the new improved technical net, no one has to wait more than an hour to get at least a partial answer. At the end of that hour, Mel goes to his mailbag where the new students that are about to become ham radio operators write him emails with questions, and we try to answer those. We then follow that with Paul's space report. WS2N keeps track of what NASA is doing. And after that first hour and a quarter, let's say, we then dig into the deeper subjects. And not everyone's interested in the deeper subjects, and that's your choice. There's 800 channels to your synthesized 2-meter receiver, and you don't necessarily have to listen to this one, but you know ahead of time that beyond the first hour and a quarter, hour and a half, the deeper subjects that not everyone's interested in will be discussed, and you can decide to go somewhere else during that period of time if that's not of your interest. Okay, as I said before, please give me your call letters and name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this, into APG, Dave and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW listening.
Daniel,
I heard you say some letters very loud. but you did not give them to me phonetically, are the three letters of your call letters Lima, Yankee, Oscar? That's a question, Danielle. Go ahead.
Ian, uniform. You got that covered?
Okay. I heard you very loud say something, and it ended in uniform. So I'm going to assume that's Lima, Yankee, uniform. Do I have your call letters correctly? And you don't have to shout, Danielle. Go ahead.
Just you with 2 years and this male at the same time. Over.
Okay, Danielle, we're only hearing the second half of each one of your conversations. You've got to press the transmitter, wait a couple of seconds, and then give us the message. Please repeat your message, Danielle.
I got 2 messages. To you and Mel, and that's it. Back to you.
Okay, you've got 2 messages, one for me and one for Mel. All righty. We'll be getting to you. All right. The first person who signed in was Lou, KC2YJC. What's new in your neighborhood, Lou?
Okay, good evening, Dick, and everybody in the net, and it's N2YJC. Dick, I got, I picked up last week a couple of Sinclair cans, one set up an FVHF, one set up as a notch filter, and one set up as a pass filter, and I have a local repeater within a quarter of a mile from me, and when I opted at the house here with a highly elevated antenna, that repeater lights me out on 146.52, the simplex frequency. So I managed to get these filters and played around with the notch filter. Fortunately, the MFJ antenna analyzer was very instrumental in helping me tune this thing. And I got to do that. But for the life of me, I don't understand what's happening inside that can. And I've heard, you know, people use them all the time. I've seen them at repeater sites. Let me drop them. I know what they're for. I know what they do. But I don't understand what's going on inside the can. I'm using the one as a notch filter. It's got a T-fitting. I go through the T, and inside the can is a loop, approximately 4 inches altogether from the center of the coax to the shield. And you rotate the loop, and you move the plunger up and down. I'm sure you know the type of filter I'm talking about. Can you give me some what in the heck is going on inside the can, Gab, and to right, JC?
Yes, I think I can, Lou. And Lou, you're going to have to hit your audio a little bit lighter. There are times when you talk close to the mic and loud, you overmodulate, and the machine chops you out. I got every one of your words because I'm listening on the input. And you being in Lindenhurst, you're in my backyard, so you're nice and strong to my input. So I heard everything, not to worry. What you're describing, these cavity filters that are used for a duplexing filter, quite often for a repeater site where you transmit and receive from the same antenna simultaneously. In the case of 2 meters, there's usually 600 kilohertz of offset between the transmit and receive frequency. And the really good duplexing filters, let me drop. The really good ones have 3 cavities devoted to the receiver, 3 cavities devoted to the transmitter, a total of 6 cavities altogether, which come together at the end with a T-connector that goes to the antenna. And if you work your way back from the T-connector, on one side the 3 cavities go to the transmitter, and the other side the 3 cavities go to the receiver. And if you take apart the receiver cavities, and if the receivers are on the low side, I may have this backwards, but I believe each of the coupling loops have an extra capacitor on them, extra inductor on the receiver ones, and the transmitter ones have an extra capacitor. What's really happening is that each individual filter is a so-called reentrant filter. In other words, there's a long rod going down the center of this chamber. The chamber really is an extremely large diameter air-filled coaxial cable. That's what it really is. And there's the equivalent of a tuning capacitor at the far end. When you adjust the main tuning screw, you're adjusting the length of that rod, which means you're either setting how many wavelengths that rod is or how close the end of it is and how much straight capacitance it's giving at the end of the cavity. In either case, that main rod has an extremely sharp resonance characteristic. It's a very sharp filter that when the thing is tuned up correctly, the input and output characteristic of one of those cavities is about half a decibel at the center frequency for each cavity. And the bandwidth is something pretty narrow, like a fraction of a megacycle. That's the good news. But that alone would not give you a good duplexing filter. In order for your transmitter, which is running in some cases 50 watts on a repeater, and 50 watts is, let me think now, 1 watt is plus 30, 10 watts is plus 40, 100 watts is plus...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
100 watts is plus 50, 50 watts is 3 dB down from that, plus 47. So your transmitter running 50 watts, if you rate it in milliwatts, it is 47 decibels stronger than 1 milliwatt. That's plus 47 dBm. dBm means decibels with reference to a milliwatt. So that's the real transmitter power coming out of your transmitter that goes to this repeater you and I are now discussing. Your receiver would like to receive a sensitivity of a signal of around minus 120 or so dBm. So minus 120 is the receiver sensitivity. Your transmitter is running plus 47. These are all in units of dBm. And the difference between those two numbers is 167 dB. Lots and lots of dBs. So just plain filtering of three cavities on the transmitter side and three cavities on the receiver side would not do that. It has a darn much transmitter power, even though it's 600 kCOA, leaking into your receiver, that the receiver would suffer desensitization. If you go to the right websites, and I think if you start Googling duplexing filters, and if you go to the books that ARRL has printed on how to set up repeaters and how to homebrew duplexing filters, you will find out that the receiver filters have this extra inductor, and the transmitter filters have this extra capacitor. I may have it backwards, but when you study what that extra element does in the appropriate cavity filter, is it creates a notch on one side. In other words, you have your normal Gaussian-shaped passband characteristic for the main center great big reentrant rod. That gives you a simple Gaussian-shaped curve. You add this extra capacitor and properly tune it, you get a notch.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You get a notch on one side. And if you can tune it carefully so that on the transmitter cavities, the notch falls on the receiver frequency, and if on the receiver frequencies, the notch falls on the transmitter frequencies, and if you set those notches up correctly, in other words, one set of cavities have got a notch on the right-hand side on your MFJ antenna analyzer, and the other set of cavities will have a notch on the left-hand side. And when you set them up correctly, it's a bit of an art form to properly tune a duplexing filter, but when you accomplish it, you do get numbers like 120 and 130 decibels between the transmit frequency and the receive frequency. You get that much isolation between the two, even though they're both connected to the same antenna at the same time, and you get something like 1.5 decibels of insertion loss on each of those transmit and receive frequencies going to the antenna. So there's a real art and science to setting up one of those notch filters. That extra capacitor, properly tuned, does that for you. As I said, once you study duplexing filters, repeater characteristics, and whatever, you'll find more information as to how it works. That's part of the story. Maybe some other people have got other ways of giving a little better explanation. If so, they're going to give me their call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Now recognize them. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, this question has come up, you know, many times with me. And I think I give a more of a very simple answer for a duplexing. Typical transmitter noise on what we usually call the 600 hertz, kilohertz spacing on 2 meters here. So away from the carrier frequency is usually about 80 dB low, 80 dB below. So the transmitter power, for instance, if you were running, say, a 60-watt transmitter, the output would be somewhere around plus 48, 50 dBm, and the noise would be minus about 32 dBm. So the duplexer must make up the difference between, say, a minus 32 and a minus 130 dBm, or approximately around, in other words, you subtract it, you would find that you need a duplexer that would have to handle a 90 dBm. So this is the basis of what, why, Dale, many times you will see many cavities, like think a standard production was used, was a commercial use, was like a six cavity type of a duplex, a deck over.
Yeah, Mel brought up a very important point. Your duplexing filter has got more than one function. I only discussed one of them, and Mel discussed the other. The raw transmit power of 50 watts, how much of that leaks into the receiver, which could create front-end overload and desensitization. That component has to be knocked down by some great number like 120 decibels. That's item number one. Item number two, every reasonable transmitter, when displayed on a really good spectrum analyzer, if everything was perfect, there would be a pure vertical line in the center of your spectrum analyzer showing that your transmit power is on 146.250, for instance. That's what I'm on right now. And there should be nothing else. Well, nobody is perfect. Every real transmitter has some noise sidebands. It looks like a small, narrow mountain. And as you tune a little bit higher in frequency, a little bit lower in frequency, the imperfections of your frequency synthesizer, of your crystal oscillator, of your voltage-controlled oscillator, the imperfections make some noise in the sidebands. At 600 kCOA, that noise will also create a desensitization of the receiver. So the duplexing filter has to knock down the raw power and the noise sidebands. So for two reasons, you're creating these notches on the transmit frequency, on the receiver side, and the receiver frequency on the transmit side, and so on. So the duplexing filter is a very busy thing, and properly aligning one is an art form. There's quite a learning curve on how to do that, and a simple spectrum analyzer used in the direct manner, let me drop, cannot do it. The average spectrum analyzer has about 80 decibels of dynamic range on the screen. If you set it up just right, a really good commercial grade or military grade spectrum analyzer may be able to display 95 decibels on the screen. And you need rejection numbers on some of those frequencies for the proper alignment of a duplexing filter. You need beyond 100 dB of rejection in order to make all this work. So you don't have the whole story, Lou, but at least you got a little bit more of it. Maybe that helps some. And by way of you looking up repeater alignment procedures, duplexing filter alignment procedures, duplexing filter design, and so on, by Googling those particular choice words, guarantee you'll find a lot more information. And Tim Berners-Lee, I saw a beautiful demonstration of his on TED, lectures, these 20-minute lectures, in which he claims that he invented the concept of HTTP and the Internet in 1989. So here we are, 22 years later, and everybody is connected by the Internet. It's amazing that that whole concept, as far as the universal interconnection of all this hardware by way of the Internet, that was only invented 22 years ago. N2YJC, K2RIW. You got it, Lou.
Saying Dick.
Mel's got a couple more words. Go ahead, Mel.
Hey, I was just going to finish and maybe even give us a little simpler explanation for many that are listening in. The difference between the output of a transmitter that's running at, say, plus 50, around 50 dBm, 48, 49, 50 dBm, and the receiver overload point, which is usually around minus 30 dBm, must be accomplished by the first section of the duplexer. So the one thing that all duplexers have in common is the use of a very high Q coaxial cavity. That's what it's based on. So that what we call the loaded Q of the cavity is affected by electrical conductivity and dielectric losses. This is what, so that's why you find that most of the duplexes are made of copper pipe, which is adequate, and the dielectric cavities, most of them, are very practical by using things like copper pipe, like Dick said, a thread screw, and some Teflon, over.
Yeah, as you homebrew or study these individual cavity filters, Lou, you'll discover that they're unloaded Q, their natural bandwidth before you add the coupling loop and the loading circuit, on numbers like 5,000 and 10,000, great big numbers, tells you what is the quality factor or how low is the internal loss. You're going to use large diameter copper pipes, usually air is the main dielectric, and down at the shorted end you have to have maybe silver plating or at least very good connection, and even copper oxide being built up on that end plate where it's screwed down to the rest of the network. You got to worry about those micro-ohms disturbing the cavity filter. There have been homebrew cavity filters that do a beautiful job the day they're manufactured, and then 2 years downrange, when copper oxide builds up at the base and those micro-ohms become milli-ohms, all of a sudden the filtering characteristics degrades a little bit and you start getting desensitization of your repeater. So there's many a homebrew duplexing filter which in the beginning does a good job, in 2 years downrange requires some refurbishing and so on. So it's quite an art form, as you can see, Lou. It's a good thing to know about. N2IJC, the microwave voice of Lindenhurst, K2RIW. You got it, Lou.
Okay, Dick, very good. interesting explanation. And I will do some homework. The basic fundamentals of why you use the filters, I completely understand, you know, desensing the receiver and so forth. But I'm still trying to understand physically what happens inside the cavity. But I'll do my homework, and next week or soon after, I'll give you my report, so to speak. All right, Dick, thanks very much, and this is N2YJC, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll throw in one more thing here, Lou. Whether it be the resonating element that does the radiating of an antenna, or whether it be the resonating element, the main rod going down the center of that cavity filter that does the filtering. In all cases, the internal Q, the internal resonance phenomena, means that energy is bouncing back and forth in that cavity a large number of times with very little insertion. If you study... If you study the internal... you'll discover that...
Thank you.
by that time, S9, probably within half a mile of the repeater site. Moving slowly, Mobile.
K2,
go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, K2, I'd be actually to give me a call. Actually, the guy is very stationary.
Not because he's moving so slowly, he appears to be.
Yeah, I'm looking at what the receiver is doing. He's not moving.
Because he's a darn, because he's so darn strong, he's capturing the limiter. He's within half a mile. Down to about S5, slowly moving, was within a tenth of a mile of the repeater, now approximately a mile away. And slowly.
Music sucks.
And slowly moving away. So, Angel, would you tell us more about the buddy pole antenna and what your question was? KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, K2RIW, the TechNet.
And so, again, he's heading towards Queens because I can hear him on the imposing crescent.
It's a dipole, but, you know, what band does it does, I know it has you buy another accessory, and you make different configurations, And that's the part that I want to see if you know about that.
Okay, Mel, you probably have some more familiarity with the Buddy Pole antenna. Tell us what you know about it and what bands it works on. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I have very little
Bill has some familiarity with it, but Bill's signal is not coming through here tonight. Let me make one more try. Anyone else on frequency with some experience with the buddy pole antenna and can tell Angel some good words on how to use it, give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. I heard an extremely weak signal in there, which I couldn't make out the call letters. Looks like we're going to have to do a little more research, and we're going to have to give ourselves some homework on this one, Angel. Looks like you didn't get the complete answer tonight, and Mel will be sending you, because you stumped the experts that have appeared tonight, Mel will be sending you a ticket for you and your best friend to have a very nice dinner. A little bit of a joke there. KC2ERR, we're going to have to get back to you on this one next week as I see it, Angel. K2RIW, you got it, Angel.
One more question. I set up my antenna on a magnet. My SWR is not the greatest. How can I prove it? Taking it away from the building. What's gonna make it a little better? The SWRs.
About the best thing I can recommend for you, other than trying various locations, is to first find out where is it giving the best performance. If you plot the standing wave ratio at 144, 145, 146, 147, 147.5, and 148 megacycles, if you plot that, you'll eventually get a bathtub-shaped curve, an upside, a U-shaped curve. And the bottom of that curve will tell you where the antenna is tuned for that particular location. So is the antenna too long or too short? That method of plotting will tell you that, Angel. And too close to the building can affect it some, whether or not the air conditioner you're sticking it to is big enough. Those are some of the factors. Is it wired correctly? Is there a broken a lead on the transmission line? By way of those plots, you'll get the first good piece of information as to how it's working and what its favorite frequency is. If, for instance, you found out that it works best at 148 megs, in other words, it's tuned high, that would tell you it's too short. Or if it gives you the best performance at 145 megs, when you want to use it at 146, that would tell you it's a little bit too long and you've got to clip off some length. Or you can also do some experimenting by putting pieces of copper foil on the tip of it and seeing if it gets better or worse. So it's going to take some experimenting, Angel. Did that make some sense, Angel? Go ahead.
Fine, there. Probably getting, I know the antenna is my mobile antenna. Do they have antennas like for people that have this situation that you could probably buy just to put on top of the air conditioner?
Eric recognized, which I'm going to turn it over to him in a minute. Most mag mount antennas will give you medium good performance when they're stuck to an air conditioner. As long as the air conditioner is not up against the side of a metal building and the tip of the antenna is only 1 foot away from a whole lot of metal frame of the window or whatever. So lots of guys have taken the mag mount, stuck it to a refrigerator or radiator or a air conditioner and had medium good performance. Let's see what Eric's got to say. KE2EJ, KE2RIW, you got it, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J. I did Google search with Buddy Paul, and there's a number of sites, eham.net, and people write about their experiences. And from what I'm seeing, you really have to be patient about tuning it. There's a bunch of different things that you have to do, and even a lot of people still use a tuner that's limited. They say that it's a great antenna, that it's trimmable. A lot of people can get an SWR of 1.5 to 1 out of it, but it takes a lot of patience to get it wherever, whatever frequency you want to operate it on, to get it there. And actually, in HF, well, not so many people really have great success putting a mag mount HF antenna on an air conditioner, but if you have a tunable coil antenna like a Hypera or whatever the name is, long as you have some kind of a counterpoise, it will work pretty well. So, you know, try and put a hot foil on a air conditioner, and you need a tuner. Keep your IWK through there.
Very fine, Eric. Eric, your signal was S9 on my input, nice and strong. Through the repeater, you were a little bit weak. And I think you're in the process of moving and setting up antennas. You probably already know this. You were 90% audio and 10% noise on the machine, even though you're S9 at my QTH. That website that you mentioned where Buddy Pole information is given, would you give that email address a little bit more slowly so that Angel can write it down? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Again, I'm probably having some multipath. I'm not moving. I'm stationary. EHAM, echoham.net.net. That's one site. Just a whole bunch of them. Just put in Buddy Pole, and you'll get a big list of things from Google.
Very fine. Good information. So by using the search word Buddy Pole on Google, and one of the good sites is EHAM.net, Angel's going to find out a lot more information about that antenna. Good to know, and I thank you. Okay, I'm going to move on to the next person, which was Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Joe is the man who does quite a bit of television DXing, and he's got this mystery he told us about last week where these unusual sidebands existed on what looks like a pair of FM channels, FM transmitters, broadcast transmitters coming from the Adirondack Drive area of Selden, Long Island. Let's see how that project is going. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. You got it, Joe.
Well, that's not what I was going to ask you about. I am going to ask you about something else, a little different then.
You got the floor. It's your choice. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. Good evening, Dick. The TechNet. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. I was trying to measure the effective sensitivity of a television receiver, a regular standard NTSC type of television. And I noticed something, I guess I've noticed this before, but I'm trying to find out maybe why it does this. The signal source was the output of a converter, because I don't have a generator, a variable generator, that's able to generate an on-frequency signal and be able to vary it. I had to use attenuation, external attenuation. But the carrier frequency I'm listening to is channel 3, so the video is at 61.25, and the audio is at 65.75, all right? That output signal was coming out of that converter box about minus 40 dBm. Got that so far?
Minus 40 dBm coming out of your signal generator, going into an attenuator, into the television set on either of those frequencies. Go ahead, Joe.
No, coming out of a converter box. This is a fixed level. I couldn't adjust this because I said I didn't have a generator. All right? And I verified the TV was tuned correctly. And it seemed to be pretty much in the ballpark by looking at the local oscillator, which is going, say, 45-25 above the video carrier. Unfortunately, 45-75 above the video carrier, but the LO approximately 107 megahertz. All right. Here's my question: as I started adding padding to try to determine the signal, the effective sensitivity of the receiver, I lost the color picture at about 15, maybe 20, about 20 dB of attenuation. I lost the color picture, and I still had a black and white picture, and still had sound. As I put more attenuation in down to a level of about 30 dB of attenuation, where I had just about had a picture viewable, what I found what happened was as I got less and less signal going to the television receiver, I had the actual tuner on the television down to even get a viewable black and white picture. If I left it on frequency, it would just simply get snow. Or really, really not much of a viewable picture. And I had to tune in a positive direction to get the sound. The TV had to go about plus 450 to be able to, the sound, 450 kilohertz, and about minus 1.2 meg to be able to get a viewable black and white picture. Can you explain what's going on with this type of phenomena that I'm viewing, that I'm seeing? Back to you, Dick.
Yes, I've seen things like this before, Joe, and I've got some guesses as to what's going on. In order to get a snow-free, well, let's say, yeah, snow-free broadcast standard television picture requires something like, I'm trying to remember what the numbers were, I think it's around 47 or 50 dB of signal-to-noise ratio, maybe it's 55. I think it's 55 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio is required in order to get a NTSC television picture snow-free. And as you make the picture weaker and weaker, when the carrier-to-noise ratio for the video, peak carrier, is around plus 30 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio, the picture is very snowy, barely watchable, and around plus 20 dB of carrier-to-noise ratio is required just to get reliable synchronization lock. So in other words, a television receiver to work correctly, because the eye is so critical, because the bandwidth is so great, and so on, requires a lot of normal carrier-to-noise ratio. The signal has got to be a lot stronger than the noise of the channel for everything to work correctly. When the signal is that strong, you're getting partial limiting of some of the IF stages. Let me drop. When I tune up an IF strip and I tune it with a weak signal, I can easily peak those stages. But if I did that, I would not have the 4 megacycles of bandwidth that's required to get good video. In order to do broadbanding, you have to do staggering of those stages. As those stages are staggered in their tuning, so that for a strong signal to give a good flat response, some amount of distortion, limiting, pulling, and whatever is taking place in those stages. As you put in a weaker and weaker signal, the actual tuning of the IF strip changes. And now, where the peak response takes place is what really counts when it comes to the real threshold signal. And you'll notice that when you got that threshold signal and you tuned it for video, you'll notice that the video was kind of mushy looking. It was kind of narrow band. Or you wouldn't see that when it comes to the audio tuning. But you really do get a change of the tuning of the IF strip for weak signals versus strong signals. Part of that is the automatic gain control action. Your automatic gain control is changing the bias voltage on various stages, which changes their Miller effect capacitance, and that changes their tuning. So there's a lot of phenomena going on here. So the broadbanding staggered tuning technique was done for a normal level signal going in, and it was not peaked up for weak level where the automatic gain control voltage is wrong, and the signal level going to the various stages is different, and their tuning changes. You are really witnessing...
1, 2, 3, 4...
I'm pretty sure you're really witnessing the change in the tuning of those various stages. That's our best guess on my part, Joe. From A2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That would account for the picture quality changing with an apparent shift, a negative shift in frequency, or where I apparently had to tune to get the, you know, a viewable picture. Not that I'm using it for amateur TV, but I guess the same effect would probably fall true with using amateur TV, with using wideband amateur TV. What about the sound? The sound's FM. It's not, that falls under the same effect? And it has two positives to actually get the sound carrier back and get, you know, decodable sound.
Yeah, depending on the design of your particular set, there used to be something called intercarrier or split sound, two different design philosophies of NTSC-type television sets. On many of the sets, there is a completely separate set of coils and a completely separate IF strip that does a tapping early in the IF stages, and there's a parallel path, so to speak, where a bunch of the signal goes through the RF 4.5 megacycle pass band IF strip in order to get the audio demodulation. So there's two separate IF strips running in parallel side by side. One ends up as the discriminator limiter, and you get audio output, and the other one ends up as the video detector. So the fact that they tune in opposite directions when the weak signals happens is not so much a mystery, because they are two completely separate circuits running in parallel side by side with a common tap-off point early up in the IF strip, not very far after the mixer. That's my best guess as to what's going on there. Let's see if Eric's got a couple of words on this one. KE2EJ, I bet you you've tuned up some NTSC television sets in your day. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric, if you're there. Looks like Eric is not there. You got it, Joe.
Okay. What all this is about is basically trying to determine if a recently acquired television set that I got is working correctly. So effectively, I'm putting a signal in at about minus 70 dBm from a signal source, a video signal source with audio, and I can get a decodable picture and audible sound. Retune the extra, get it. I guess it was telling me that the device itself is working. It's not blowing up or having a deaf front end. I have another side question for you. I don't know if you were watching television yesterday, trying to watch Channel 2 at all yesterday. Were you trying to view Channel 2 from New York yesterday at all in your leisure hours?
I sure was. I sure was. Mel, we'll go to you in a second. I sure was, and Channel 2 faded out on me. Was that due to a band opening? Were you seeing Channel 2 from long distances away and the co-channel interference? My digital demodulator couldn't tolerate it. Was that what was going on, Joe? Go ahead.
Yeah, KTK, well, I'll give it to you in a moment. Just hang on there. Yes, that's exactly what happened because I experienced exactly the same thing. And this is a rarity for me because I'm on the other side of the hill, or the ridge that goes pretty much down Long Island. That was WFSB in Hartford that was actually knocking out Channel 2 because when I put my antenna at a 010 reading, I got that station full scale, and it was like that for quite a number of hours.
How about that? Yeah, I was having trouble understanding why Channel 2 faded out on me. That's one of my most reliable channels. 4, 4-1, 4-2, and 4-4 I always have trouble with. 5-2 I always have trouble with. 9-1 I always have trouble with. 9-2 is good. 5-1 is good. But the 4s are terrible. And 2 is very reliable, except for last night, late last night. And at first I thought it was a failure of my converter. And then I said, I should have tuned around to see if there were other long-distance channels I could have received. If I was doing some television DXing, what other channel should I have started looking for, in your opinion, Joe? Go ahead.
I went up and down the band like I usually do periodically, and I was getting WUNI, I think it was, on channel 46, digital channel 18, and they're in the northeast corner of, Massachusetts, they're west of Boston in that area. That one I was getting pretty good, and I was getting something on channel 20 that was other than the one in Hartford, or the one other than Hartford, something out there, but I couldn't lock up on it successfully. But I think the whatever was opening up as far as band up, it was not only going north of here, but it's also south because I went on RF 26 and RF 34 and I was able to copy two different stations from the Philadelphia area quite easily. In fact, I had the same effect happening on channel 34, which is a Spanish channel. I put the antenna at about 220 degrees, and I was able to get channel RF. RF 34 is channel 10 from Philadelphia, quite viewable for quite a length of time. So you do have to get a rotor up there. One closing comment, then only see digital TV since you brought that up. I did a measurement off the air of the carriers that come out of New York, and I'll just give you a quick rundown very quickly as far as what do you call a scallop pattern or not. 17 yes, 18 no, 21 no, that's not in New York, 24 no, 28 yes, that's NBC, 30 no, 31 no, 33 yes, 34 no, 36 no, 38 yes, that's channel 9, 40 no, 44 no.